There was no crying the second time I entered the house. I walked slowly through the downstairs, keeping the flashlight in my hand until I had turned on every light I could find. If there were people still boating on the north end of the lake, old Sarah probably looked like some weird Spielbergian flying saucer hovering above them. I think houses live their own lives along a time stream that's different from the ones upon which their owners float, one that's slower. In a house, especially an old one, the past is closer. In my life, Joanna had been dead nearly 4 years, but to Sarah, she was much nearer than that. It wasn't until I was actually inside, with all the lights on and the flash returned to its spot on the bookshelf, that I realized how much I had been dreading my arrival, of having my grief reawakened by signs of Joanna's interrupted life. A book with a corner turned down on the table at one end of the sofa, where Jo had liked to recline in her nightgown, reading and eating plums. The cardboard canister of Quaker oats, which was all she ever wanted for breakfast, on a shelf in the pantry. Her old red robe hung on the back of the bathroom door in the south wing, which Bill Dean still called the new wing, although it had been built before we had ever seen Sarah lapse. Brenda Meserve had done a good job, a humane job, of removing these signs and signals, but she couldn't get them all. Joe's hardcover set of Sayers's Peter Wimsey novels still held pride of place at the center of the living room bookcase. Joe had always called the moose head over the fireplace Bunter, and once, for no reason I could remember, certainly it seemed a very un-Bunter-like accessory, she had hung a bell around the moose's hairy neck. It hung there still on a red velvet ribbon. Mrs. Meserve might have puzzled over that bell, wondering whether to leave it up or take it down, not knowing that when Joe and I made love on the living room couch, and yes, we were often overcome there, we referred to the act as ringing Bunter's bell. Brenda Meserve had done her best, but any good marriage is secret territory, a necessary white space on society's map. What others don't know about it is what makes it yours. I walked around, touching things, looking at things, seeing them new. Joe seemed everywhere to me, and after a little while I dropped into one of the old cane chairs in front of the TV. The cushion wheezed under me, and I could hear Joe saying, "Well, excuse yourself, Michael." I put my face in my hands and cried. I suppose it was the last of my mourning, but that made it no easier to bear. I cried until I thought something inside me would break if I didn't stop. When it finally let me go, my face was drenched, I had the hiccups, and I thought I had never felt so tired in my life. I felt strained all over my body, partly from the walking I'd done, I suppose, but mostly just from the tension of getting here and deciding to stay here, to fight. That weird phantom crying I'd heard when I first stepped into the place, although it seemed very distant now, hadn't helped. I washed my face at the kitchen sink, rubbing away the tears with the heels of my hands and clearing my clogged nose. Then I carried my suitcases down to the guest bedroom in the north wing. I had no intention of sleeping in the south wing, in the master bedroom where I had last slept with Joe. That was a choice Brenda Meserve had foreseen. There was a bouquet of fresh wildflowers on the bureau and a card, "Welcome back, Mr. Noonan." If I hadn't been emotionally exhausted, I suppose looking at that message in Mrs. Meserve's spiky copperplate handwriting would have brought on another fit of the weeps. I put my face in the flowers and breathed deeply. They smelled good, like sunshine. Then I took off my clothes, leaving them where they dropped, and turned back the coverlet on the bed. Fresh sheets, fresh pillowcases. Same old Noonan sliding between the former and dropping his head onto the latter. I lay there with the bedside lamp on, looking up at the shadows on the ceiling, almost unable to believe I was in this place and this bed. There had been no shroud thing to greet me, of course, but I had an idea it might well find me in my dreams. Sometimes, for me at least, there's a transitional bump between waking and sleeping. Not that night. I slipped away without knowing it, and woke the next morning with sunlight shining in through the window and the bedside lamp still on. There had been no dreams that I could remember, only a vague sensation that I had awakened sometime briefly in the night and heard a bell ringing, very thin and far away.